This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. In 2014, Sofia Amoroso, founder of the online fast fashion site Nasty Gal, published the book Girl Boss. It would sell more than 500,000 copies and become sort of a how-to guide for ambitious young women trying to excel in male-dominated corporate America.
A girl boss is sort of a subcategory of female corporate leader. Young, progressive, forward-thinking, upwardly mobile, ambitious women who cared a lot about fashion and cared a lot about feminism, but also were really interested in their personal success.
That's The Atlantic's Amanda Mull there, and we're going to hear more from her in just a moment. Girl Boss became the template for women in the workforce hoping to take back some of the power for themselves. That ethos was touted by leaders at companies like The Wing and Reformation, which claimed to demonstrate a commitment to progressive feminist values. As conversations about inequality and racism in the workplace have gained more traction, a number of female leaders have left the companies they founded after being accused of fostering environments that were harmful to their non-white employees. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and she recently published a piece called The Girl Boss Has Left the Building. I asked Amanda about the appeal of the Girl Boss movement back in the 2010s.
Well, there's a couple things that contributed to the Girl Boss perfect storm of sorts that happened in the mid-2010s. The year before Sofia Amoroso's book came out, Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook published Lean In, which sold millions of copies and suggested to a curious audience that the way to master your career and have it all, as it were, is just to dedicate yourself more fully to mastering the existing power structures of corporate America. And so those two books were sort of a 1-2 punch that landed with a group of young women who, raised by baby boomer mothers, who largely worked during their childhoods, who had, as a generation, created a lot of progress for women in the workplace. And those women arrived on the job market, those daughters arrived on the job market, you know, after the Great Recession, when the future of sort of professional prosperity that had been promised to them had evaporated. And I think a lot of them were sort of looking around at the world that they lived in, which was not quite the world they had been promised, and were trying to find a way to forge ahead and still find that sense of personal success that they had been striving for much of their lives.
Who are the girl bosses that we're generally talking about here, Amanda? I mean, when I say who, I mean, I feel like a lot of the names that we'll talk about here are largely white women of a certain amount of privilege and social capital, and not to mention maybe economic capital, financial capital as well. Am I right?
Right. The people who succeed in corporate America, no matter their gender, are generally white people, generally people who come from a solid financial background, people who are well pedigreed, who went to the correct universities, who got good grades, who got the correct internships and had the familial financial support to take those internships and live in expensive cities for no pay, and who don't have to worry as much about student loans and things like that. So you get a group of women who largely mirror the socioeconomic demographics of the men who have always led corporate America, but now it's women.
And you've written, and I'm going to quote here, that, quote, slotting mostly white women into the power structures usually occupied by men does not de facto change workplaces, let alone the world, for the better if the structures themselves go untouched. And I think I would love for you to talk about that in this context, because it feels like that's the same conversation we're having at the national level when it comes to systemic racism.
I think that a problem that we're sorting out in America is that American culture loves to blame things on the actions of individuals. So when you see a problem of corporate America and of, you know, widespread workplace abuses and difficulty for people of color and difficulty for women rising up the ranks to the same levels of success as their white male peers, the urge is to blame men or to blame particular men. But really the problem there is the structures and incentives that create that success. Those structures were created by largely white men. But when you put other people into those positions and ask them to climb the ranks like the white men who came before them, in order to succeed in those situations, they're going to make largely the same decisions that the people who came before them made, which means that results in the same types of abuses, the same types of labor problems, the same types of discrimination that we've always seen in American workplaces. So just changing the identity of a person who wields that power and a person who responds to those incentives is not going to change the power itself or the incentives themselves, which is what you'd need to do in order for the experiences of the people who work for those companies to be meaningfully improved.
Amanda, some of the places where we've seen women, female leaders step down were once celebrated themselves for how progressive those places were. And I'm talking about places like The Wing, Refinery 29, how essentially they were, you know, pushing forward a very progressive idea and cause and space. And yet a lot of the environments that they were working in, the workers at a lot of these places have told stories about how difficult and toxic the environments were and how they did not align with the, at least the outward facing message that these companies wanted to portray. There have been accusations of toxicity and fostering environments that were difficult for Black and Brown employees. Like, tell us a little bit about what these women did.
Largely, they did the same things that male executives have done for ages. They get into trouble because in the aftermath of Lean In and Girl Boss and their success and the success of those ideas, in the hope that, you know, elevating women and quote unquote empowering women in the workplace would help solve these problems, an effective way for entrepreneurs, for female entrepreneurs to find funding and to find markets and to find willing audiences of consumers was to emphasize their intent to do things differently, emphasize their own feminist values, emphasize their interest in employing more women, employing more people of color. So as these values became widely celebrated in culture, American business pivoted to take advantage of them. I think that probably a lot of these women went into these endeavors feeling really sincere about their intentions, or at least some of them did. But when you enter into a system that, again, incentivizes abuses and incentivizes inequality and incentivizes you to pay people as little as possible and get as much work out of them as possible in order to satisfy your own goals and to satisfy the goals of your investors and your other executives, you're often going to end up making the same decisions that would be made by the CEOs that you defined yourself in opposition to when you were starting your company, which I think is just another illustration of the fact that it's the system itself that sets people up to be mistreated in these workplaces.
A lot of this really connects to, you mentioned Lean In, Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In at the very top of this conversation, and that how that influenced the rise of hashtag Girl Boss. And a lot of that is really just what some folks would call corporate feminism. Is there a role for corporate feminism going forward, Amanda, in this moment that we're in right now?
I would say no. I would say that corporations, the best thing that they can do is to begin ceding power to people that exist outside of the power structure that they exist in. And when you get corporate feminism or corporate anti-racism, that is often an attempt by the companies in question to monopolize some of the existing cultural conversation and existing cultural momentum to shore up their own business. So I think that instead of adopting these issues as their own and coding them into the marketing of their businesses, what they need to do is start to make real structural concessions to the people that they have fundamentally excluded in the past.
You're talking about real change, Amanda.
I am. We all are right now, aren't we?
That's right. That's right. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Amanda, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.